So we're getting close to, I've got tonight's lesson and one more lesson that we're going to do next week. And then Jesse Daniels is going to be taking over for the month of March. And then after that, we're going to try to go on to a rotation every Wednesday night, on Wednesday nights for about a month. We're going to have a different teacher each month. So each teacher will be taking 1 month and presenting a four-week lesson. And we're going to go with that rotation for a while. And so any of the men of the congregation, that if you would like to teach on Wednesday nights, get with me or one of the elders, and we'll get that arranged. Right now I've got Jesse Daniels for the month of March, and Kevin Wright's going to be taking the month of April, with the exception of the 26th, I believe. So, which I'll take care of that. So we've got the next 2 months taken care of, but if you would like to get something together, I would surely appreciate it, and we'd like to hear from you. So tonight, we're going to finish up, hopefully, the evidence of Christ in answering the question of who is Christ, and what do we think of Christ, whose son is he? We had posed that question last week, and the Sadducees couldn't really adequately answer that question, or they didn't want to answer that question. The Pharisees didn't want to answer that question, but we, as Christians, want to answer that question, who is Christ, what is he, and what does he mean to us? And we talked about some of the Old Testament prophecies concerning Christ, and how that there were different kingdoms that were presented in Daniel, and how it was all leading to Christ, how Genesis points to Christ. And there were a great many Old Testament prophecies, around, I think it was like 62 Old Testament prophecies that all point to Christ, or messianic in nature, or Messiah prophecies. And they all came about. And we left off last week talking about Christ in the Old Testament. And I want to take a look about Isaiah, the 40th chapter, verse 3. And I'll be reading from the English Standard Version. Isaiah 40, verse 3. And it says, "A voice cries in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, make straight in the desert a highway of our God." Now, this particular prophecy is not just, it is messianic in nature, but it's also talking about who? Any idea? John the Baptist, right? So this is a twofold prophecy. If we take a look in Matthew, the 3rd chapter, verses 1 through 3, we can see its fulfillment there. "In those days, John the Baptist came preaching in the wilderness of Judah, 'Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand, for this is he who was spoken of by the prophet Isaiah, when he had said, the voice of one crying in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, make his paths straight.'" Not only is it a quotation from Isaiah, it's the fulfillment of prophecy. So, is it just coincidence? Did John the Baptist just see that prophecy, was aware of that prophecy, and said, "Hey, you know what? I'm going to be that voice in the wilderness. I'm going to be that guy." What do we know about John the Baptist? I mean, he was a real socialite, right? You know, he was a real up-and-comer, a professional, and had all kinds of riches and stuff, right? No. He ate bugs. Yum. Well, okay, no. Some people really like to eat bugs, okay? I get that. He ate locusts and honey, and he had camel hair tunics, and he lived out in the wilderness. He wandered around. He did not have a luxurious lifestyle at all. So does it seem reasonable that this man would live this kind of lifestyle and preach the way he did? What was the end result of John the Baptist's preaching? He lost his head. He was beheaded. He was serious enough about his preaching that he did it to death and was dedicated to that. So maybe he was a lunatic. Well, maybe he wasn't the only one. That's a question that we have to answer. John, the first chapter, verse 23. Let's take a look at that. John, the first chapter, verse 23, in relation to John the Baptist. He said, "I am the voice of one crying out in the wilderness, make straight the way of the Lord, as the prophet Isaiah said." So this prophecy is corroborated not just by Matthew, but also by John and many, many others. John the Baptist had a myriad of followers, and such to the point that he was very, very popular and was troubling the ruling culture of the Jews, the religious entities there, and eventually lost his head because of him preparing the way for Christ. Let's take a look at Isaiah, the 53rd chapter. This entire chapter is absolutely amazing whenever we take in consideration the story of Christ, or the account of Christ. I don't like to use the word story because I believe it is a historical account and not just a fiction, where some people want to say this is a fiction. We've got, 12 verses. Let's just read through those real quick because I think it's the whole chapter is worth it. Who has believed what he has heard from us? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he grew up from him like a young plant, like a root out of dry ground. And this entire chapter is messianic prophecy. So as we read this, it's describing Christ. He grew up as a root out of dry ground. What does a root out of dry ground look like? Is that something that's very attractive? It's not appealing. Whenever you look at a tree, you want to see the root structure. You don't want to see the root structure. Whenever you see the root structure, there's problems there. It's kind of a gnarly looking thing. And it's saying that Christ was not a comely man or a pretty boy. He was as a root out of dry ground. For he grew up before him like a young plant, like a root out of dry ground. He had no form or majesty that we should look at him, and no beauty that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by man, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. I think that accurately describes Jesus' life for the most part. He didn't really have many possessions. He had no home to where he could rest. He was almost nomadic in his preaching. Yeah, Mom.
Going back to the root, I had seen those maple trees that the roots come out of the ground.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, well, I'll just take a pickaxe and chop those up. He can't. They are hard. They are so hard that you can't even saw them. Not are they ugly coming up to the surface like they are. They're hard as nails.
They're quite undesirable, right?
Totally.
Right. the major point that the writer here, Isaiah, is bringing about is the attraction of Christ is not his personality, his charisma, or his visage, but his love and his actions are desirable, and that's what draws people to him and who he actually is. Acquainted with sorrows. We don't like to hang around with people that are Debbie Downers and depressing people. But the fact that he's acquainted with sorrow doesn't mean that he was not an optimistic. Quite the contrary. I think if anybody was optimistic, it was Christ. He looked at the best in people. But acquainted with sorrow means that he had a very troubled life. And we can definitely see that that coincides with Christ's life, especially the end. So continue on there in verse 4. Surely he has borne our griefs and has carried our sorrows. Yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace, and in his wounds we are healed. Doesn't that sound a whole lot like the crucifixion story? The crucifixion account? It's exactly what happened. Kevin.
What do you think it means, that phrase in verse 2, or in verse 3, when it says, "And as one from whom men hide their faces."
And as one from whom men hide their faces. Another translation says, as one who hides his face from us. So I guess it could be, I would have to take a look at the Hebrew on that. It could be taken in two different ways. I would have to say in the fact that the nature of Christ I'm not real sure about that. I'd have to take a. That's
makes you wonder. In one sense, that maybe if you look at it the way that last translation was, almost as if he was ashamed to show his face, and then the other translation, ESV, makes it sound like we were almost too ashamed to look at him. You know, it's really a kind of.
I would think. I mean, I could think of it in both ways. I could actually come up with an idea. Scripture talking about he is deity, right? So no one has looked upon the face of God and lived. So in one sense, whenever they looked upon Christ, his deity or a portion of his deity is laid aside. Because we've seen the account with Moses, and that God placed him in the cleft of the rock and let him see the backside of him, and the glory of God shone upon Moses in such an extreme nature that the children of Israel said, "Hey, put a bag over your head because we can't stand the light that's coming off of your face." So the intensity of God's presence is such that no one can see him and live. So in one sense, I would say, okay, maybe it's talking about that his deity is partially set aside, in that we do not behold his full glory, so he hides his true face from us. But then again, we could also say, like you had said, that we should be ashamed to show our face to him because of who he is, because he is the deity, that he is the lamb that is worthy to be slain and take the sins of the world away. So we can take it both directions. Dale, you got a thought?
I realize punctuation was added later.
Yes, it was.
But you know, the way that you were reading from the ESV earlier, so I'm just kind of going with that, the way they have put the translation down and continued, there's no break in the thought continuing to the next line. As one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised, and we esteemed him not.
Correct.
And it's
so continuing that same thought.
That's part of the same thought, and it seems to me, if that is the correct translation of the thought, that Jesus was presented in the time that was given. Mm-hmm. His fame grew, much as his fame grew, he had reactions either accepting, whether wholly or just for a time. He had those who rejected him.
So it continues the thought that he was rejected.
Yeah.
I could go with that. That seems to go well with the continuity of the verse. But I would be interested to go back and take a look at the Hebrew on that and see which way that phrase goes, because we have two different translations there. So I'm not certain fully on that, but I do like Dale's take on that, and I kind of lean more towards that. Surely he has borne our griefs and has carried our sorrow, yet we esteem him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace, and with his wounds we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. Like a lamb that was led to the slaughter, and like a sheep that was before his shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. Whenever he was before Pilate, what was the constant questioning that Pilate was asking Christ, and what was Christ's constant response? There was always this questioning by Pilate of, don't you realize who I am? Don't you realize that I have your life in my hand? I have the power to kill you. Don't you want to defend yourself? Pilate was looking for ways to release him because he didn't see any guilt in him, and he wanted to release Christ. But what did Christ do? Did Christ defend himself, and did he say, yep, you're right. You know what? I'm completely innocent. You should set me free. He didn't defend himself. He said, it is what it is. Pilate asked, are you God? And he says, you say that I am. They say that I am. He did not deny the accusations that that he proclaimed to be the Son of God, that he proclaimed to be God incarnate. He didn't deny those things. He was silent, like the lamb that it's described here, is silent before the slaughterer, before the shearer. He didn't open up his mouth. It is a foreshadow of things to come, and in such a way that it is an absolute mirror image of what happened to Christ. By oppression and judgment he was taken away, and as for his generation, who considered that he was cut out of the land of the living, stricken for the transgressions of my people? And they made his grave with the wicked, with a rich man in his death, although he had done no violence. Who was crucified on either side of Christ? Two thieves, two malefactors, two criminals. He made his grave with the wicked. I think that's pretty accurate. And then with a rich man in his death. Well, how does that translate? His tomb. His tomb was the tomb of a rich man. So in his death, he was with a rich man. Although he had done no violence, Pilate, again and again, like I said, was trying to free him. He found him innocent, but the Jews wanted him slain. So that's what happened. Yet it was the will of the Lord to crush him. He has put him to grief. When his soul makes an offering for guilt, he shall see his offspring. He shall prolong his days, and the will of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. Out of the anguish of his soul, he shall see and be satisfied. By the knowledge shall the righteous one, my servant, make many to be accounted righteous. And that's exactly what Christ's blood did. And made it possible for each and every single one of us to be righteous. Not that I don't want to be misunderstood. We do have righteousness of our own. Now, granted, our righteousness is like filthy rags. I mean, without Christ, it's nothing. But we do have action in our lives. We must do the will of God. We must take part and have an active role in that righteousness. Therefore, I will divide him a portion with the many, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong, because he poured out his soul to death and was numbered with the transgressors, yet he bore the sins of many and makes intercession for the transgressors. And that's exactly what he does today. His sacrifice made that all possible. So here in the Old Testament, we can definitely see that parallel of the prophecy of the crucifixion of Christ. I mean, going through Isaiah, the 53rd chapter, that was the crucifixion story. And I hope you were able to see it. I mean, just reading that, I mean, I kind of expounded on a few things, so hopefully you can see it a little bit better. But just reading that, it is an accurate representation of that. So, Dale, go ahead before I make this last statement on this.
When Philip joined up with the eunuch, what was the eunuch greeting?
Isaiah.
He
preached Jesus. Absolutely. Good point. Great point. So I forgot my point. That was an excellent point, though. Thank you. It took me totally off my train of thought. Let's go ahead and talk about Christ as a man. How much time I got, Tim? Am I doing okay? Not really, but okay. All right, good deal. Let's take a look at 1 Timothy 2:5. 1 Timothy 2:5. It says, "For there is one God, and there is one mediator between God and men, the man, Christ Jesus." So here it definitely states that Jesus was a man. Well, how do we reconcile that with John 1, we know that Christ was also deity. I'm going to kind of skip over some of this line for brevity of time. Let's go ahead and go to John 1, the first chapter, verses 1 through 3. And this should be fairly familiar to most of you. "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made." So we have to determine who is the Word. What is the Word? Well, John further illustrates who that Word is down in verse 14 through 18. "The Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and he was seen, and we have seen his glory. Glory as the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. John bore witness about him," John the Baptist, "and cried out, 'This was he of whom I said, he who comes after me ranks before me, because he was before me. For from his fullness we have all received grace upon grace. For the law was given through Moses, grace and truth came through Jesus Christ.'" So the Word that John spoke of there in the beginning of the chapter is further identified as Jesus Christ. So we definitely see, go back up there to 1:1, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God," definitively. So here we see two instances that the Scriptures say that Jesus is man and Jesus is deity. Now, there are three conclusions to the question of who is Christ. Who do we say he is? Whose son is he? Is he the Son of Man? Is he the Son of God? One of the possible answers is that he is a liar. Like I illustrated earlier with John the Baptist. Was John the Baptist a liar and just a kook that decided I'm going to follow what Isaiah said, and I'm going to be that voice crying the wilderness. Is Jesus a liar? Well, if Jesus is a liar, what sane man would be willing to die for what he knows is a lie? So if he's a liar, he's an insane liar. Now, if he's a lunatic, if he's insane, would a lunatic keep even an even balanced mind amidst persecution, amidst attacks against him? Would a lunatic stay the course amongst temptations, traps, and calmly and deliberately answer any kind of challenge that was presented to him in a rational, logical, and scriptural way? Jesus shut the mouths of the Sadducees. He shut the mouths of the Pharisees. He responded to their accusations and shut their mouths with rational arguments. A lunatic would not do such. It would take more than a Jesus to invent a Jesus. Jesus is exactly who he said he was. He said and proclaimed that he was the Son of God. And whenever I say the Son of God, I mean he was on equal terms with God the Father. Whenever we say the word Son, we think of that as a lower position. But in that age, in that culture, what was the position of the eldest son? What was their portion of the will? Whenever the father died, the eldest son received half of everything, and then the other half was portioned to all the other siblings. So the firstborn son was on equal terms with the father. Dale. The head. Correct. So whenever we think of son in terms modern-wise, we think of it as a derogatory position, but that is not what Jesus proclaimed. In that culture, he proclaimed to be on equal terms with the Father. So in the eyes of the Jews, he definitely was saying, and they understood definitively whenever he said that he was the Son of God. That's why they got so upset about it. He was saying that he was God in the flesh. There was no doubt about it. They understood it, and he understood exactly what he said.
They would not have picked up stones if they didn't understand.
They wouldn't have tried to kill him if they didn't understand it. Kevin.
And a liar and a lunatic wouldn't have risen from the dead.
Absolutely. And that's,
none of them have risen from the dead.
That's the final proof. That's the final evidence that Jesus is who he said he was, and he was not a liar. He was not a lunatic. And his resurrection is corroborated by many witnesses. Not just a couple, many witnesses. He was seen by multitudes of people after his death. Yeah. Very good. Absolutely.
Yeah, the last thing they wanted was for him to be resurrected. His enemies, that's for sure.
It's kind of hard for a lunatic to replicate that. It's kind of hard for a liar to come up with that. Like I said, if he was a liar, if he was a lunatic, it would take a greater Jesus than Jesus to invent a Jesus. Thank you all for your attention. Thank you for your participation. We're going to talk about next week. We're going to finish up with Genesis, the first 11 chapters of Genesis in 1 week. whether those first 11 chapters are allegory, fiction, or actual historical documentation. So, thank you very much.